seconds. There was a string of barrister firms on Broad Street, from the Exchange to St. Michael's, and I pictured the two of us partnered in one of them with a signboard out front. Grimke and Grimke. Of course, there would be an out-and-out skirmish with the rank and file, but with Thomas at my side and Father at my back, nothing would prevent it. I bore down on Father's law books every afternoon myself. In the mornings, I read aloud to Hetty in my room with the door bolted. When the air cooked to unbearable degrees, we escaped to the piazza. And there, sitting side by side in the swing, we sang songs that Hetty composed, most of them about traveling across water by boat or whale. Her legs swung back and forth like little batons. Sometimes we sat before the windows in the second floor alcove and played Lace the String. Hetty always seemed to have a stash of red thread in her dress pocket, and we spent hours passing it through our upstretched fingers, creating intricate, bloodshot mazes in the air. Such occupations are what girls do together. But it was the first occasion for either of us, and we carried them out as covertly as possible to avoid Mother putting an end to them. We were crossing a dangerous line, Hetty and I. One morning, while Charleston turned miserably on the brazier of summer, Hetty and I lay flat on our stomachs on the rug in my room while I read aloud from Don Quixote. The week before, Mother had ordered the mosquito nettings out of storage and affixed above the beds in anticipation of the blood-sucking season. But having no such protection, the slaves were already scratching and clawing at their skin. They rubbed themselves with lard and molasses to draw out the itch, and trailed its eau de cologne through the house. Hetty dug at an inflamed mosquito bite on her forearm and frowned at the book pages as if they were some kind of irresolvable code. I wanted her to listen to the exploits of the knight and Sancho Panza, but she interrupted me repeatedly, placing her finger on some word or other, asking, "What does that one say?" And I would have to break off the story to tell her. She'd done the same thing recently as we read The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, and I wondered if, perhaps, she was merely bored with the antics of men, from the shipwrecked to the chivalrous. As I sent my voice into dramatic lilts and accents, trying to lure her back into the tale, the room grew dark, tinctured with an approaching storm. Wind blew through the open window, coming thick with the smell of rain and oleander, swirling the veils of the mosquito net. I stopped reading, as thunder broke and rain splattered across the sill. Hetty and I leapt up in unison and drew down the pane. And there, swooping low in the yellow gloom, was the young owl that Charlotte and Hetty had fed faithfully through the spring. It had grown out of its fledgling ways, but it had not vacated its residence in the woodpile. I watched it fly straight toward us, arcing across George Street and gliding over the workyard wall, its comical barn owl face strikingly visible. As the bird disappeared, Hetty went to light the lamp, but I was fixed there. What came to me was the day at the woodpile when Charlotte first showed me the bird, and I remembered the oath I'd made to help Hetty become free. A promise impossible to fulfill, and one that continued to cause me no end of guilt. But it suddenly rang clear in me for the first time. Charlotte said I should help Hetty get free, any way I could. Turning, I watched her carry the lantern to my dressing table, light swirling about her feet. When she set it down, I said, "Hetty, shall I teach you to read?" Equipped with an elementary primer, two blueback spellers, a slate board, and a lump of chalk, we began daily lessons in my room. Not only did I lock the door, I screened the keyhole. Our tutorials went on throughout the morning for two or more hours. When we ended them, I wrapped the materials in a swath of coarse cloth, known as Negro cloth, and tucked the bundle beneath my bed. I'd never taught anyone to read, but I'd been tutored in copious amounts of Latin by Thomas, and subjected to enough of Madame to devise a reasonable scheme. As it turned out, Hetty had a knack. Within a week, she could write and recite the alphabet. Within two, she was sounding out words in the spellers. I'll never forget the moment when she made the magical connection in her mind, and the letters and sounds passed from nonsense into meaning. After that, she read through the primer with growing proficiency. By page 40, she had a vocabulary of 86 words. I recorded and numbered each one she mastered on a sheaf of paper. When you reach 100 words, I promised her, we'll celebrate with a tea. She began to decipher words on apothecary labels and food jars. How do you spell Hetty? She wanted to know. How do you spell water? Her appetite to learn was voracious. Once, I glimpsed her in the workyard writing in the dirt with a stick, and I raced into the yard to stop her. She'd scrawled W-A-T-E-R with exact penmanship for the entire world to see. What are you doing? I said, rubbing the letters away with my foot. Someone will see. She was equally exasperated with me.
Don't you think I got my own foot to rub out letters if somebody comes along?
She conquered her 100th word on the 13th of July. We held her celebratory tea the next day on the hipped roof of the house, hoping to catch sight of the Bastille Day festivities. We had a sizable French population from St. Domingo, a French theater, and a French finishing school on every corner. A French hairdresser frizzed and powdered Mother and her friends, regaling them with accounts of the guillotining of Marie Antoinette, which she claimed to have witnessed. Charleston was British to the soles of its feet, but it observed the destruction of the Bastille with as much zeal as our own independence. We climbed into the attic with two china cups and a jar of black tea spiked with hyssop and honey. From there, we mounted a ladder that led to a hatch in the roof. Thomas had discovered the secret opening at 13 and taken me up to wander among the chimneys. Snow spotted us as he drove Mother home from one of her charity missions, and without a word to her, he'd climbed up and retrieved us. I'd not ventured here since. Hetty and I nestled into one of the gullies on the south side with our backs against a slope. She claimed never to have drunk from a china cup, and gulped quickly, while I sipped slowly and stared at the hard blue pane over our heads. When the populace marched in procession along Broad Street, they were too far away for us to see, but we heard them singing the Hymn des Marseillois. The bells of St. Philip's chimed, and there was a salute of 13 guns. Birds had been loitering on the roof, and scatterings of feathers were here and there. Hetty tucked them into her pockets, and something about this created a feeling of tenderness in me. Perhaps I was a little drunk on hyssop and honey, on the novelty of being girls together on the roof. Whatever it was, I began telling Hetty confidences I'd kept only with myself. I told her I was accomplished at eavesdropping, that I'd stood outside Charlotte's room the night she was punished and heard the story she told.
I know, she said. You're not so good at snooping as you think.
I spilled every possible secret. My sister Mary despised me. Thomas had been my only friend. I'd been dismissed as an unfit teacher of slave children. But she shouldn't worry. It was not due to incompetence. As I went on, my revelations turned grave. I saw Rosetta being whipped one time, I told her. I was 4. That was when the trouble with my speech began.
You seem like you're talking all right now.
It comes and goes.
Was Rosetta hurt bad?
I think it was very bad.
What'd she do wrong?
I don't know. I didn't ask. I couldn't speak afterward, not for weeks. We turned taciturn, leaning back and gazing at the crenulated clouds. Talk of Rosetta had sobered us more than I'd intended, far too much for a tea celebrating 100-word vocabulary. Hoping to restore the mood, I said, I'm going to be a lawyer like my father. I was surprised to hear myself blurt this out, the crown jewel of secrets, and feeling suddenly exposed, I added, "But you can't tell anyone."
"I don't have nobody to tell, just Mama."
"Well, you can't even tell her. Promise me." She nodded. Satisfied, I thought of the lava box and my silver button. "Do you know how an object can stand for something entirely different than its purpose?" She looked at me blankly while I tried to think of a way to explain. "You know my mother's cane, for instance? How it's meant to help her walk, but we all know what it stands for?"
"Whacking heads."
After a pause, she added,
"A triangle on a quilt stands for a blackbird wing."
"Yes, that's what I mean. Well, I have a stone box in my dresser with a button inside. A button is meant for fastening clothes, but this one is beautiful. Just plain uncommon. So I decided to let it stand for my desire to be a lawyer."
"I know about the button. I didn't touch it, I just opened the box and looked at it."
I don't mind if you hold it," I told her.
"I have a thimble, and it stands for pushing a needle and keeping my fingertip from turning sore. But I could let that stand for something else."
When I asked her what, she said,
"I don't know, except I want a soul like Mama."
Hetty got into the spirit. She retold the entire story I'd overheard her mother tell that night about her grandmother coming from Africa, appliquing quilts with the triangles. When Hetty talked about the spirit tree, her voice took on a reverential tone. Before we went back down the hatch, Hetty said,
"I took a spool of thread from your room. It was laying in your drawer, no use to anybody. I'm sorry. I can bring it back."
"Oh. Well, go ahead and keep it. But please, Hetty, don't steal any more. Even little things. You could land in terrible trouble." As we descended the ladder, she said,
"My real name is Handful."
Handful. Mama came down with a limp. When she was in her room or in the kitchen house for meals, she didn't have any trouble. But the minute she stepped in the yard, she dragged her leg like it was a dead log. Aunt Sister and them watched her go lame and shook their heads. They didn't like that kind of trick and didn't mind saying it. Mama told them, "After you get your one-legged punishment, you can say all you want. Till then, you best shut up." After that, they stayed clear of her. Stopped talking if she showed up, started back when she left. Mama said it was a hateful shun. Her eyes burned with anger all the time now. Sometimes she turned her blackened stare on me. Sometimes she turned it to cleverness. One day I found her at the foot of the stairs, explaining to Mrs. she had a hard time climbing up to do her sewing. And for that matter, a hard time climbing the carriage house steps to her room. She said, "But I gonna make out somehow, don't worry." Then while Mrs. and me watched, she pulled on the banister and dragged herself to the top, calling on Jesus the whole way. Next we know, Mrs. had Prince clear out a big room in the cellar, on the side of the house that backed up to the workyard wall. He moved Mama's bed in there and all her stuff, took the quilt frame down from her old ceiling and nailed it on the new one. Mrs. said Mama would do all the sewing in her room from here out and had Prince bring down the lacquer sewing table. The cellar room was large as three slave rooms put together. It was bright whitewash and had its own tiny window near the ceiling, but looking through it, you didn't see clouds in the sky. You saw bricks in the wall. Mama made it a calico curtain anyway. She got hold of some pictures of sailing ships from a cast-off book and tacked them on the wall. A painted rocking chair turned up in there, along with a beat-up toilet table she covered with tickling bird cloth. On top, she set empty colored bottles, a box of candles, a cake of tallow, and a tin dish piled with coffee beans for her chewing pleasure. Where she got all this hoard? I don't know. Along the wall shelf, she laid out our sewing stuff. The patch box, the pouch with needles and thread, the sack of quilt stuffing, pin cushion, shears, tracing wheel, charcoal, stamping papers, measuring ribbons. Sitting off by themselves was my brass thimble and the red thread I stole from Miss Sarah's drawer. Once Mama got the place fixed like a palace, she asked Aunt Sister could they all come give a prayer for her poor, sorry room. One evening here came the lot of them all too glad to see how poor and sorry it was. Mama offered each of them a coffee bean. She let them look to their heart's content. Then she showed them how the door locked with an iron slide bolt, how she had her own privy pot under the bed, which it fell to me to empty, considering how crippled she was. She made a lot over the wooden cane Missus had given her for getting round. When Aunt Sister left Mama's party, she spit on the floor outside the door, and Cindy came behind her and did the same thing. Best thing was, I could get to the new room without leaving the house. More nights than not, I crept down the 2 flights from Sarah's room, sidestepping the creaks. Mama loved that lock on her door. If she was in her room, you could be sure it was latched, and if she was sleeping, I had to pound my knuckles sore till she roused. Mama didn't care any more about me leaving my post. She'd snatch open her door, yank me in, and bolt it back. Under the covers, I'd ask her to tell me about the spirit tree, wanting to know more detail of it, every leaf, branch, and nest. When she thought I was sleeping, she got up and paced the room, humming a quiet sound through her lips. Those nights, something dark and heedless was loose in her. By day, she sat in her new room and sewed. Miss Sarah let me go down every afternoon and stay until supper time. A little air might fuss round Mama's window, but it was like a smelter in there most of the time. Mama would say, "Get yourself busy." I learned to baste, gather, pleat, shire, gore, and gusset. Every stitch there is. I learned to do a buttonhole and a shank, cut a pattern from scratch without stamping powder. That summer I turned 11 years, and Mama said the pallet I slept on upstairs wasn't fit for a dog. We were supposed to be working on the next ration of slave clothes. Every year the men got 2 brown shirts and 2 white, 2 pants, 2 vests. Women got 3 dresses, 4 aprons, and a headscarf. Mama said all that could wait. She showed me how to cut black triangles, each one big as the end of my thumb. Then we appliqued 200 or more on red squares, a color Mama called oxblood. We sewed on tiny circles of yellow for sun splatter, then cranked down the quilt frame and pieced everything together. I hemmed on the homespun back in myself, and we filled the inside with all the batting and feathers we had. I cut a plug of my hair and plug of Mama's and put them inside for charms. It took 6 afternoons. Mama had stopped stealing and taken up safer ways to do harm and wreckage. She'd forget, so-called forget, that Mrs. Sleeves were basted loose and one of them would pop open at church or somewhere. Mama had me sew on buttons without knots and they would fall off Mrs. Bosom on the first wear-round. Everybody with an ear could hear Mrs. shout at Mama for her laziness, and Mama cry out, "Oh, Mrs., pray for me. I wants to do better." I can't say what all mischief Mama did, just what I saw, and that was plenty. She accidentally broke whatever piece of china or table figurine was sitting around, flipped it over and kept walking. When she saw the tea trays Aunt Sister left in the warming kitchen for Cindy to take up, she would drop whatever bit of nastiness she could into the teapot. Dirt off the floor, lint off the rug, spit from her mouth. I told Miss Sarah, stay clear of the tea trays. Day before the storm came, a still feeling weighed on the air. You felt like you were waiting, but you didn't know what for. Tomfrey said it was a hurricane and battened down. Prince and Sobby closed the house shutters, stored the work yard tools in the shed, and fastened up the animals. Inside, we rolled up carpets on the first floor and moved the fragiles from near the windows. Mrs. had us bring the food rations inside from the kitchen house. It came in the night while I was in bed with Mama. The wind screamed and threw limbs against the house. So many palm trees rattled in the dark, Mama and I had to shout to hear each other. We sat in the bed and watched the rain pitch against the high window and pour in round the edges. Flood water washed under the door. I sang my songs loud as I could to take my mind from it. Cross the water, cross the sea, let them fishes carry me. If that water take too long, carry me on, carry me on. When the storm finally passed, we swung our legs onto the floor and the water cut circles above our ankles. Mama's so-called poor, sorry room had turned into a poor, sorry room. At low tide next day, the flood water drew back, and everyone got called to the cellar to shovel out the mud. The workyard was a mess of sticks and broken palm fans, water pails, and horse feed, the door off the privy, whatever the wind had grabbed and dropped. A piece of ship sail was hung in the branches of the spreading tree. Once we got Mama's room cleaned up, I went out to see the sail in the tree. It waved in the breeze, making a strange sight. Beneath the branches, the ground was a wet slate of clay. Taking a stick, I wrote, "Baby, boy, blue, blow your horn, Hetty," digging the letters deep in the starchy mud, pleased at my penmanship. When Aunt Sister called me to the kitchen house, I smeared over the words with the toe of my shoe. The rest of the day, the sun shone down and dried out the world. Next morning, while me and Mama were in the dining room waiting for devotions, Miss Mary came hurrying down the hallway with Mrs. trotting behind her, headed for the back door. Mama leaned on her cane and said, "Where they tearing off to?" Looking from the window, we saw Lucy, Miss Mary's waiting maid, under the tree, and the sail still caught in the branches. We saw Miss Mary lead Mrs. cross the yard right to where Lucy stood looking at the ground. And the hot feeling came up from my stomach and spread over my chest. "What they looking at?" Mama said, watching how the three of them tipped from their waists and studied the dirt. Then Lucy ran full tilt back toward the house. Drawing close, she yelled, "Handful! Handful! Mrs. say, come out here right now." I went, full knowing. My words, straight from the speller, were baked in the clay. The smear over of mud from my shoe had crackled and thinned away, leaving the deep crevice of the letters. "Baby boy blue, blow your horn, Hetty."
Sarah. 2 days after a September hurricane sent tidewater over East Bay all the way to Meeting Street, Binna knocked on my door before breakfast, her eyes filled with fear and consolation, and I knew some catastrophe had fallen. "Has someone died? Is Father..."
"No, ain't nobody die. Your daddy, he wants you in the library."
I'd never been summoned like this, and it caused an odd, plummeting sensation in my legs. So much so I dipped a little at the knees while walking back to the Hepplewhite to inspect the ivory ribbon I'd been tying in my hair. "What's happened?" I asked, tugging the bow, smoothing my dress, letting my hand rest for a moment across my jittery stomach. I could see her reflection in the glass. She shook her head.
"Miss Sarah, I can't say what he won't, but it ain't helped a poke."
Placing her hand at the small of my back, she nudged me from the room, past Handful's new quilt lying in the hallway, its massive triangles pinioned on the floor. We walked down the stairs, pausing outside the library door. Abstaining from her "poor Miss Sarah's," Binna said instead,
"Listen to Binna now. Don't be crying, and don't be running away. Buck yourself up now."
Her words, meant to steady me, unnerved me further. As I tapped on the door, the airy feeling returned to the back of my knees. He sat at his desk with his hair oiled and combed back smooth and didn't look up, intent on a stack of documents. When he lifted his face, his eyes were hardened.
"You have disappointed me, Sarah."
I was too stunned to cry or run away, the two things Benna had warned against. "I would never knowingly disappoint you, Father. I only care to..." He thrust out his palm.
"I have brought you here to listen. Do not speak."
My heart beat so ferociously my hands went to either side of my ribs to keep them from unhinging.
"It has been brought to my attention that your slave girl has become literate. Do not think to deny it, as she wrote a number of words on the muddy ground in the yard, and even took care to sign her name."
"Oh, Handful, no!" I looked away from his harsh, accusing eyes, trying to arrange things into perspective. Handful had been careless. We'd been found out. But my disbelieving mind could not accept that Father, of all people, believed her ability to read was an unpardonable offense. He would chastise me as he must, undoubtedly at Mother's urging. Then he would soften. In the depths of his conscience, he understood what I'd done.
"How do you suppose she acquired this ability?"
he asked calmly.
"Did it descend upon her one day out of the blue? Was she born with it? Did she teach her own ingenious self to read?" "Of course, we know how the girl came to read. You taught her. You defied your mother, your father, the laws of your state, even your rector, who expressly admonished you about it."
He rose from his leather chair and walked toward me, stopping at arm's reach. And when he spoke again, some of the hostility had left his voice.
"I've asked myself how you are able to disobey with such ease and disregard. I fear the answer is you are a coddled girl who does not understand her place in the world, and that is partly my own fault. I've done you no favors with my lenience. My indulgence has given you the idea you can transgress a serious boundary such as this one."
Feeling the chill of some new and different terror, I dared to speak, and felt my throat clench in the familiar old way. I squeezed my eyes and forced out my thought. "I'm sorry, Father. I meant no harm."
"No harm?"
He hadn't noticed the return of my stammer. He paced about the stuffy room and lectured me, while Mr. Washington gazed serenely from the mantel.
"You think there's no detriment in a slave learning to read? There are sad truths in our world, and one is that slaves who read are a threat. They would be abreast of news that would incite them in ways we could not control. Yes, it's unfair to deprive them, but there's a greater good here that must be protected."
But, Father, it's wrong," I cried.
"Are you so impudent as to challenge me even now? When you left the document on my desk, freeing your slave girl, I should have brought you to your senses then and there. But I cosseted you. I thought by tearing the fool thing in two and returning it to you, you would understand we Grimkes do not subvert the institutions and laws by which we live, even if we don't agree with them."
I felt confused and very stupid. Father had torn up my manumission paper. Father.
"Do not mistake me, Sarah. I will protect our way of life. I will not tolerate sedition in this family."
When I espoused my anti-slavery views during those dinner table debates, Father beaming and spurring me on, I'd thought he prized my position. I'd thought he shared my position. But it hit me suddenly that I'd been the collared monkey dancing to his master's accordion. Father had been amusing himself. Or perhaps he'd encouraged my dissenting opinion only because it gave the rest of them a way to sharpen their own opposing views. Perhaps he'd tolerated my notions because the debates had been a pitying oral exercise to help a defective daughter speak. Father crossed his arms over his white shirt and stared at me from beneath the unclipped hedge of his brows. His eyes were clear and brown and empty of compassion. And that's when I first saw my father as he really was. A man who valued principle over love.
"You have quite literally committed a crime," he said, and resumed his pacing, making a wide, slow orbit around me. "I will not punish you accordingly, but you must learn, Sarah. From now on, you are denied entrance to this room. You shall not cross this threshold at any time, day or night. You are denied all access to the books here, and to any other books wherever they might be, except for those Madame Ruffin has allotted to your studies."
No books. God, please. My legs gave way then, and I went onto my knees. He kept circling.
"You will study nothing but Madame's approved subjects. No more Latin sessions with Thomas. You will not write it, speak it, or compose it in your head. Do you understand?"
I lifted my hands, palms up, as high as my head, molding myself into the shape of a supplicant.
"Father, I beg you, please don't take books from me. I can't bear it."
"You have no need of books, Sarah."
"Father!"
He strode back to his desk.
"It causes me distress to see your misery, Sarah. But it's fait accompli. Try not to take it so hard."
From the window came the rumble of drays and carriages, the cries of slave vendors on the street. The old woman with the basket atop her head who squawked,
"Red rose tomatoes."
The din of commerce went on without regard. Opening the library door, I saw Binna had waited. She took my hand and led me up the stairs to the doorway of my room.
"I'll get you some breakfast and bring it up here on a tray," she said.
After she left, I peered beneath the bed where I'd kept the slate board, spellers, and primer. They were gone. The books on my desk were gone, too. My room had been scoured. It was not until Binna returned with the tray that I thought to ask,
"Where's Handful?"
"Oh, Miss Sarah, that just it. She about to get her own punishing out back."
I have no memory of my feet grazing the stairs.
"It just one lash," Binna cried, racing behind me. "One lash, Mrs. Say, that be all."
I flung open the back door. My eyes swept the yard. Handful's skinny arms were tied to the porch rail of the kitchen house. 10 paces behind her, Tomfrey held a strap and stared at the ground. Charlotte stood in the wheel ruts that cut from the carriage house to the back gate, while the rest of the slaves clustered beneath the oak. Tomfrey raised his arm.
"No!"
I screamed.
"No!"
He turned toward me, hesitating, and relief filled his face. Then I heard Mother's cane tap the glass on the upstairs window, and Tomfrey lifted his tired eyes toward the sound. He nodded and brought the lash down across Handful's back.
Handful. Tomfrey said he tried not to put much force in it, but the strike flayed open my skin. Miss Sarah made a poultice with balm of Gilead buds soaked in Master Grimke's rum, and Mama handed the whole flask to me and said, "Here, go on, drink it too." I don't hardly remember the pain. The gash healed fast, but Miss Sarah's hurt got worse and worse. Her voice had gone back to stalling and she pined for her books. That was one wretched girl. It'd been Lucy who ran tattling to Miss Mary about my lettering under the tree, and Miss Mary had run tattling to Mrs. I judged Lucy to be stupid, but she was only weak-willed and wanted to get in good with Miss Mary. I never did forgive her, and I don't know if Miss Sarah forgave her sister, 'cause what came from all that snitching turned the tide on Miss Sarah's life, her studying was over and done. My reading lessons were over, too. I had my 100 words, and I figured out a good many more just using my wits. Now and then, I said my ABCs for Mama and read words to her off the picture pages she tacked on her wall. One day I went to the cellar, and Mama was making a baby gown from muslin with lilac bands. She saw my face and said, "That's right, another Grimke coming. Sometime this winter, Mrs. ain't happy about it." I heard her tell Massa, "That's it. This the last one." When Mama finished hemming the little gown, she dug in the gunny sack and pulled out a short stack of clean paper, a half-full inkwell, and a quill pen, and I knew she'd stole every one of these things. I said, "Why you keep doing this?" "I need you to write something." "Write, Charlotte Grimke has permission for traveling. Under that, put the month, leave off the day, and sign Mary Grimke with some curly Q." First off, I don't know how to write Charlotte. I don't know the word permission either. Then write, "This slave is allowed for travel." "What are you gonna do with it?" She smiled, showing me the gap in her front teeth. "This slave gonna travel. But don't worry, she always coming back." "What you gonna do when a white man stops you and asks to see your pass and it looks like some 11-year-old wrote it?" "Then you best write it like you ain't some 11-year-old. How you plan on getting past the wall?" She looked up at the window near the ceiling. It wasn't big as a hat box. I didn't see how she could wriggle through it, but she would grease herself with goose fat if that's what it took. I wrote her pass 'cause she was bent on hell to have it. After that, at least one or two afternoons a week, she took off. Stayed gone from middle of the afternoon till past dark. Wouldn't say where she went. Wouldn't say how she got in and out of the yard. I worked out her escape path in my head, though. Outside her window, it wasn't but a couple of feet between the house and the wall, and I figured once she squeezed through the window, she would press her back against the house and her feet against the wall and shimmy up and over, dropping to the ground on the other side. Of course, she had to find another way back in. My guess was the back gate where the carriage came and went. She never came back till it was good and dark so she could climb it and nobody see. She always made it before the drums beat for curfew. I didn't want to think of her out there hiding from the city guard. One afternoon while me and Mama were finishing up the slave clothes for the year, I laid out my reasoning, how she went out the window in daylight and came back over the gate at dark. She said, "Well, ain't you smart?" In the far back of my head, I could see her with the strap tied on her ankle and round her neck. And I filled up and started begging, "Don't do it no more, please. All right? You gonna get yourself caught. I tell you what, you can help me. If somebody here find me missing, you sit the pail next to the cistern where I can see it from the back gate. You do that for me." This scared me worse. "And if you see it, what you gonna do? Run off? Just leave me?" Then I broke down. She rubbed my shoulders the way she always liked to do. "Handful, child. I would soon die before I leave you. You know that. If that pail sit by the cistern, that just helped me know what's coming, that's all." When their social season was starting off again, and me and Mama couldn't keep up with all the gowns and frocks, she up and hired herself out without permission. I learned it one day after the supper meal while we were standing in the middle of the workyard. Miss Sarah had been in one of her despairs all day, and I thought the worst things I had to fret over was how low she got and Mama slipping out the window. But Mama, she pulled a slave badge out from her pocket. If some owner hired his slave out, he had to buy a badge from the city. And I knew Master Grimke hadn't bought any such. Having a fake badge was worse than having Mrs. Green silk. I took the badge and I studied it. It was a small square of copper with a hole poked through the top so you could pin it to your dress. It was carved with words. I sounded them out till it finally came clear what I was saying. "Domestic. Domestic servant." "Domestic servant?" I cried. "Number 133, year 1805, Where'd you get this? Well, I ain't been out there grogging and lazying around this whole time. I've been finding work for myself. But you got more work here than we can see to. And I don't make nothing from it, do I? She took the badge from me and dropped it back in her pocket. One of the Russell slaves, named Tom, has his own blacksmith shop on East Bay. Mrs. Russell let him work for hire all day, and she don't take but 3/4 of what he make. He made this badge for me, copied it off a real one. I had the mind of an 11-year-old, but I knew right off this blacksmith wasn't just some nice man doing her a favor. Why was he putting himself in danger to make a fake badge for her? She said, I'm gonna be making bonnets and dresses and quilts for a lady on Queen Street, Mrs. Allen. I told her my name was Pearl, and I belonged to Master Dupree on the corner of George and East Bay. She said to me, you mean that French tailor? I say, yes'm. He can't fill my time no more with work, so he letting me out for hire. What if she checks on your story? She an old widow. She ain't gonna check. She just say, show me your badge. Mama was proud of her badge and proud of herself. Mrs. Allen say she paying me by the garment, and her 2 daughters need clothes and covering for their children. How you gonna get all this extra work done? I got you. I got all the hours of the night. Mama burned so many candles working in the dark, she took to swiping them from whatever room she happened on. Her eyes grew down to squints, and the skin around them wrinkled like drawing a straight stitch. She was tired and frayed, but she seemed better off inside. She brought home money and stuffed it inside the gunny sack, and I helped her sew day and night. Anytime I didn't have duties drawing Miss Sarah's baths, cleaning her room, keeping up with her clothes and her privy pot. When we got the widow's orders done, Mama would squirm out the window and carry the parcels to her door where she got more fabric for the next batch. Then she would wait till dark and sneak over the back gate. All this dangerous business got natural as the day was long. One afternoon, during a real warm spell in January, Mrs. sent Cindy to the basement to fetch Mama. Something about rosettes falling off her new Empire waist dress, and, of course, Mama was gone over the wall. She didn't lock the door while she was out, because she knew Mrs. would have Prince saw the door off its hinges if she didn't answer. And how was she going to explain an empty room behind a locked door? News of a missing slave flies like brush fire. When I heard the news, my heart dropped to my knees. Mrs. used her bell and gathered everybody in the yard up near the back door. She laid her hands on top of her big pregnant belly and said, if you know Charlotte's whereabouts, you are duty-bound to tell me. Not a peep from anybody. Mrs. cast her eyes on me. Hetty, where is your mother? I shrugged and acted stumped. I don't know, Mrs. Wish I did know. Mrs. told Tomfrey to search the kitchen house, laundry, carriage house, stable, storage shed, privy, and slave rooms. She said comb every nook in the yard, look down the chute where Prince sent hay from the loft to the horse's trough. If that didn't turn up Mama, she said Tomfrey would go through the house, the piazza, and the ornament garden, top to bottom. She rang her bell, which meant go back to work. I hurried to Mama's room to check the gunny sack. All her money was still at the bottom under the stuffing. Then I crept back outside and set the pail next to the cistern. The sun was coming down the sky, turning it the color of apricots. While Tomfrey did his searching high and low, I took up my spot in the front alcove on the second floor to wait. At the first shade of dark, lo and behold, I looked down through the window, and there was Mama turning the corner. She marched straight to the front door and knocked. I tore down the stairs and got to the door the same time as Tomfrey. When he opened it, Mama said, I gonna give you half of a dollar if you get me back in there safe. You owe me, Tomfrey. He stepped out onto the landing, me beside him, and closed the door. I threw my arms around Mama. She said to him, quick now, what it gonna be? They ain't nowhere to put you, he said. Mrs. had me search every corner. Not the rooftop, I said. Tom Free made the coast clear, and I led Mama to the attic and showed her the ladder and the hatch. I said, when they come, you say it was so warm you came out here to see the harbor and lay down and fell asleep. Meanwhile, Tom Free went and explained to Mrs. how he forgot about the rooftop when he was searching, how he knew for a fact Charlotte had been up there one time before. Mrs. waited at the foot of the attic steps with her cane, huffing from climbing the stairs big as she was. I lurked behind her. I was trembling with nerves. Mama came down the ladder, shivering, telling this cockamamie story I'd come up with. Mrs. said, I did not think you were as naturally dumb as the rest, Charlotte, but you have proved me wrong. To fall asleep on the roof. You could have rolled off onto the street, the roof. You must know such a place is completely off limits. She raised her cane and brought it down across the back of Mama's head. See yourself to your room, and tomorrow morning after devotions, you are to sew the rosettes back on my new dress. Your sloppiness with the needle has only worsened. Yes'm, Mama said, hurrying to the stairs, waving me in front of her. If Mrs. noticed how Mama didn't have her cane or her limp, she didn't say so. When we reached the cellar, Mama shut the door and threw the lock. I was winded, but Mama's breath was steady. She rubbed the back of her head. She set her jaw. She said, I is a remarkable woman, and you is a remarkable girl, and we ain't never gonna bow and scrape to that woman.
Sarah. The idea of a new sibling didn't strike me as happy news. Shut away in my room, I absorbed it with grim resignation. When pregnant, Mother's mood became even fouler. And who among us would welcome that? My real dismay came when I took paper and pen and worked out the arithmetic. Mother had spent 10 of the last 20 years pregnant. For pity's sake! Soon to be 12, I was on the cusp of maidenhood, and I wanted to marry. Truly I did. But such numbers petrified me. Coming as they did, so soon after my books being taken away, quite soured me on the female life. Since Father's dressing down, I hadn't left the four walls of my room except for meals, Madame Ruffin's class 3 mornings a week, and church on Sunday. Handful kept me company, asking questions to which she didn't care to know the answer, asking only to animate me. She watched me make feeble attempts at embroidery and write stories about a girl abandoned to an island in the manner of Robinson Crusoe. Mother ordered me to snap from my inwardness and misery, and I did try, but my despair only grew. Mother summoned our physician, Dr. Gettings, who after much probing decided I suffered from severe melancholy. I listened at the door as he told Mother he'd never witnessed a case in someone so young. That this kind of lunacy occurred in women after childbirth, or at the withdrawal of a woman's menses. He declared me a high-strung, temperamental girl with predilections to hysteria, as evidenced by my speech. Shortly after Christmas, I passed Thomas's door and glimpsed his trunk open on the floor. I couldn't bear his leaving, but it was worse knowing he was going off to New Haven to pursue a dream I myself had, but would never realize. Consumed with envy for his dazzling future, I fled to my room where I sobbed out my grief. It gushed from me in black waves, and as it did, my despondency seemed to reach its extremity, its farther limit, passing over into what I can only now call an anguished hope. All things pass in the end, even the worst melancholy. I opened my dresser and pulled out the lava box that held my button. My eyes glazed at the sight of it. And this time I felt my spirit rise up to meet my will. I would not give up. I would err on the side of audacity. That was what I'd always done. My audacious airing occurred at Thomas's farewell party, which took place in the second-floor withdrawing room on Twelfth Night. During the past week, I'd caught Father smiling at me across the dining table, and I'd interpreted his Christmas gift, a print of Apollo and the Muses, as an offering of love and the end of his censure. Tonight, he conversed with Thomas, Frederick, and John, who was home from Yale, all of them in black woolen topcoats and striped vests of various colors. Father's flaxen. Seated with Mary at the Pembroke table, I watched them and wished to know what they debated. Anna and Eliza, who'd been allowed at the festivities, sat on the rug before the fire screen, clutching their Christmas dolls, while Ben pitted his new wooden soldiers in battle, shouting, "Charge!" every few seconds. Mother reclined against the red velvet of her rosewood récamier, which had been brought up from her bedroom. I'd observed five of Mother's gestations, and clearly this was her most difficult. She'd enlarged to mammoth proportions. Even her poor face appeared bloated. Nevertheless, she'd created an elaborate fete. The room blazed with candles and lamplight, which reflected off mirrors and gilt surfaces, and the tables were laid with white linen cloths and gold brocade runners in keeping with the colors of the Epiphany. Tomfrey, Snow, and Eli served, wearing their dark green livery, hauling in trays of crab pies, buttered shrimps, veal, fried whiting, and omelette souffle. My prodigal appetite had returned, and I occupied myself with eating and listening to the whir of bass voices across the room. They conversed about the re-election of Mr. Jefferson, whether Mr. Meriwether Lewis and Mr. William Clark had any chance of reaching the Pacific coast, and most tantalizing, what the abolition of slavery in the northern states, most recently in New Jersey, boded for the South. Abolition by law? I'd never heard of it, and craned to get every snippet. Did those in the North, then, believe God to be sided against slavery? We finished the meal with Thomas's favorite sweet, macaroons with almond ice, after which Father tapped a spoon against his crystal goblet and silenced the room. He wished Thomas well and presented him with an abridgment of Locke's essay concerning human understanding. Mother had allowed Mary and me to each have half a flute of wine, my inaugural taste, and I gazed at the book in Thomas's hand with a downy feeling between my ears.
"Who will send Thomas off with a tribute?" Father said, scanning the faces of his sons. Firstborn John tugged on the hem of his vest, but it was I, the sixth-born child and second daughter, who leapt to my feet and made a speech.
"Thomas! Dear brother, I shall miss you. I wish you Godspeed with your studies."
I paused and felt an upwelling of courage.
"One day I intend to follow in your footsteps. To become a jurist."
When Father found his tongue, his tone was full of amusement.
"Did my ears deceive? Did you say you would follow your brother to the bar?"
John twittered, and Frederick laughed outright. Father looked at them and smiled, continuing,
"Are there female jurists now? If so, little one, do enlighten us."
Their hilarity burst forth, and I saw Thomas, too, was laughing. I tried to answer, not fully comprehending the depth of their derision, that his question was for the benefit of my brothers alone.
"Would it not be a great accomplishment if I should be the first?"
At that, Father's fun turned into annoyance.
"There will be no first, Sarah, and if such a preposterous thing did occur, it will be no daughter of mine."
Still I went on stupidly, blindly.
"Father, I would make you proud. I would do anything."
"Sarah, stop this nonsense. You shame yourself. You shame us all. Where did you ever get the notion you could study the law?"
I fought to stand there, to hold on to what felt like some last dogged piece of myself.
You said I would be the greatest jurist.
I said if you were a boy.
My eyes flitted to Anna and Eliza, who gazed up at me, and then to Mary, who would not meet them. I turned to Thomas.
Please, do you remember? You said I should be the jurist.
Sarah, I'm sorry, but Father is right.
His words finished me. Father made a gesture with his hand, dismissing the matter, and the band of them turned from me and resumed their conversation. I heard Mother say my name in a quiet way. She no longer reclined, but sat upright, her face bearing a commiserate look.
"You may go to your room," she said.
I slinked away like some scraped-out soul. On the floor beside my door, Handful was coiled into her red squares and black triangles. She said,
"I put on your lamp and stoked the fire. You need me to help with your dress?"
No. Stay where you are." My words sounded flat with hurt. She studied me, uncertain.
"What happened, Miss Sarah?"
Unable to answer, I entered my room and closed the door. I sat on the dresser stool. I felt strange and hollow, unable to cry, unable to feel anything but an empty, extinguished place in the pit of my stomach. The knock at my door moments later was light, and thinking it was Handful, I gathered the last crumbs of my energy and called out,
I have no need of you.
Mother entered, swaying with her weight.
I took no joy in seeing your hopes quashed, she said. Your father and brothers were cruel, but I believe their mockery was an equal portion to their astonishment. A lawyer, Sarah? The idea is so outlandish I feel I have failed you bitterly.
She placed her palm on the side of her belly and closed her eyes as if warding off the thrust of an elbow or foot. The gentleness in her voice, her very presence in my room, revealed how distressed she was for me. And yet she seemed to suggest their unkindness was justified.
Your father believes you are an anomalous girl with your craving for books and your aspirations, but he's wrong.
I looked at her with surprise. The hauteur had left her. There was a lament in her I'd never seen before. Every girl comes into the world with varying degrees of ambition, she said. Even if it's only the hope of not belonging body and soul to her husband. I was a girl once, believe it or not. She seemed a stranger. A woman without all the wounds and armature the years bring. But then she went on, and it was Mother again.
The truth, she said, is that every girl must have ambition knocked out of her for her own good. You are unusual only in your determination to fight what is inevitable. You resisted, and so it came to this, to being broken like a horse.
She bent and put her arms around me.
Sarah, darling, you fought harder than I imagined, but you must give yourself over to your duty and your fate and make whatever happiness you can. I felt the puffy skin of her cheek, and I wanted both to cling to her and shove her away. I watched her go, noticing she hadn't closed the door when she'd entered. Handful would have heard everything. The thought comforted me. There's no pain on earth that doesn't crave a benevolent witness. As Handful appeared, regarding me with her large, soulful eyes, I took the lava box from my dresser, removed the silver button, and dropped it into the ashbin by the fire, where it disappeared beneath the gray and white soot. The following day, the withdrawing room was cleared for Mother's lying in. She'd birthed her last six children there,
surrounded by Benna, Aunt Sister, Dr. Gettings, a hired wet nurse, and two female cousins.